dresses. But even the plain attire ain't enough to detract from Miss Duncan's beauty. Mr. Redfern's eyes settle on her as soon as we enter the sitting room, where most of the attendees have gathered for drinks. Coming over to greet our party, he's the spitting image of the civilized savage the papers are always discussing. Well-cut jacket, fashionable waistcoat, hair pulled back in a queue, well-worn boots, and a bowie knife strapped to his waist. The perfect combination of gentleman and ruthless killer. Just like the main character in some frontier adventure. He wears it like a costume, and I get the feeling Mr. Redfern also likes to use the low expectations of people to his advantage. Either way, it is most definitely a style that works for him, judging from the way Miss Duncan lights up. While Miss Anderson and Mr. Redfern exchange pleasantries, I note that he wears the knife on his right side. Mr. Redfern is left-handed, an interesting fact that I file away for later. Mr. Redfern's eyes barely even take in the rest of us before he bows deeply to Miss Duncan.
It is a pleasure to have your company for the evening meal, ladies. If you would follow me, I would be happy to make introductions.
Miss Duncan, for her part, smiles widely. Thank you, sir. I'm afraid I'm at a loss because I never got the privilege of your name. The two of them make eyes at each other for a minute, sharing a secret. Mr. Redfern smiles.
My apologies. I am Daniel Redfern.
Miss Duncan gives a quick curtsy. Pleased to make your acquaintance, Mr. Redfern. Amelia Duncan. I don't know who they think they're fooling with this act, but I'm convinced utterly that they are already well acquainted. Miss Duncan knows Mr. Redfern. But how? She catches me scowling at her and raises a questioning eyebrow. I smooth my expression and turn my attention back to the introductions. Miss Duncan gestures at me and Catherine. I trust you already know the girls.
Yes, we have met.
Mr. Redfern nods politely at Miss Anderson and Catherine before his eyes settle on me, his pleasant expression going hard.
Follow me, he says.
I stand there, baffled, as they all file off to meet the creme de la creme of Baltimore's elite. It might be my imagination, but I do believe this is the third time Mr. Redfern has looked at me as though he'd like nothing more than to use me as shambler bait. I take my time following for the introductions, getting a feel for the house before making my way through the crowd. The sitting room is large, and off to the side is a massive dining room with seating for 40. The rooms here are lit by regular old gas lamps. I suppose the mayor put the electric ones outside to show off to guests and passers-by. I watch as Mr. Redfern introduces Catherine and the Mrs. Duncan and Anderson to a group of women clustered together like a group of chattering hens, their broad chests puffed out in self-importance. One glance at their faces has me walking in the opposite direction. Mama always said a healthy serving of scorn before dinner keeps a girl slim. I remain posted up near the doorway while Catherine and the instructors circulate through the crowd. From here, I can see right into the dining room and the majority of the sitting room while being blissfully ignored. In the dining room, servants are putting out place settings. A pasty-complexioned man barks out orders to the servants, most of them darker than me. They're older, and they have the hangdog look I associate with the folks who came up enslaved, who never knew a taste of freedom until it was too late for them to properly embrace it. But one of the men walks with his head a little too high, as though he knows his worth. He's lighter than the rest, his shoulders thrown back in a proud way, a sparkle of mischief in his two light eyes. Red Jack. He looks out of place in a servant's white shirt and jacket, gloves on his hands. The bruising on his face is barely noticeable, no doubt covered up by cosmetics from one of the working girls he knows. What does he think he's doing, trying to hide in plain sight when the mayor's boys roughed him up not 2 days ago. He sees me enter and pauses for a moment, raising a single eyebrow in a way that says, "Look at you, all cleaned up." I give him my best glare, and he just winks at me. Watching the preparations for dinner causes a lump to rise up in my throat. A wave of homesickness like I've never felt washes over me, and I place a hand on my middle. Sudden tears threaten, and I blink hard to force them away. It's been so long since I've been to Rose Hill that I wonder if the whole memory ain't some kind of fever dream. Does my mama even miss me? All my memories of Rose Hill are filled with her. Her voice, her delicate beauty. But here, so many miles from home, I have to wonder if the place even exists. For all the letters I post to her regularly, Mama hasn't written me in over 10 months. Is she even still alive? I could be writing to a ghost. Or worse, a shambler. It's a question I've refused to ask myself. I don't want to think about what it would do to my world if Mama is dead. The only thing that's kept me going at Miss Preston's is the way Mama looked at me when the truant officer pulled me away toward the waiting pony. "Be the best. Learn what you need to learn and come back to me," she'd said. So I will. Now, I'm almost ready to graduate from Miss Preston's. But I have no idea if there even is a Rose Hill to return to anymore. What is my future? This right here? Standing at the edge of a room like a piece of furniture? The dinner bell rings, jarring me out of my reverie. I slip out of the dining room and into the gathering area, falling back to where the ladies mill about, waiting for their escorts. Catherine looks over as I sidle up, wearing her lemon-eating face. "Where have you been?" she whisper yells at me. "I was right there in the doorway, watching the entrances. Why are you so out of sorts?" Catherine just gives a quick shake of her head, and I shrug. Whatever's amiss, she ain't sharing. Well, Jackson is in the dining room, by the by, all decked out like a servant. I glance over in the direction of the white ladies, who talk to each other behind fans and gloved hands. They cast us curious glances that ain't the least bit friendly. I look around the room and frown. Where are their girls? Catherine glances around as well.
That is an excellent question, Jane. Perhaps you would have heard how most of them were dismissed after their cowardly behavior at the lecture, if you had joined us in the sitting room.
They dismissed their girls? Just like that? Catherine adjusts her gloves and ducks her head in respectful acknowledgement to a young fellow that can't seem to stop staring at her.
Just like that. But get this. Apparently there is some sort of scandal with folks going missing. The Edgars never made it home from Miss Preston's 2 weeks ago. Their pony was overrun, and they were consumed by shamblers. All things you would know if you hadn't been off skulking about.
I was watching the entrance. Catherine silences me with a single glare.
There's something going on here. Between the Edgars and the Spencers? Keep your head about you, Jane. And in the meantime, don't ruin this opportunity for me.
Folks line up to enter the dining room. The mayor and his wife at the front of the line. Catherine and I stand along the wall at attention, but even though we're doing just what we're supposed to, I can feel Miss Anderson's glare burrowing into me, and I stand a little straighter. I ain't going to afford that woman an excuse to give me any grief, but mostly, I don't want to ruin things for Catherine. The mayor and his survivalist pals may be as corrupt as the night is long, but this is the life she wants. And even though I'm lukewarm on her, I won't do anything to stand in the way of her future. Formal dinners require a procession from the sitting rooms into the dining room,
a process I find to be the height of silliness. All the men and women pair off and go marching in to eat food that's like it's not gotten cold by the time they get there. A handsome young swank comes to offer his arm to Catherine, and she reddens. Oh, no, I'm sorry, sir. I'm an attendant. The man looks like he's about to object to her polite refusal, but then he catches an older woman's eye and moves off to escort a homely girl in a yellow dress instead. Once everyone is filed into the dining room, Catherine and I follow the dinner party in. Well, that was a whole barrel full of awkward, I say.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Catherine says stiffly, her eyes darting around like she's afraid she might be on the dinner menu.
We take up our places along the wall opposite the serving board, a space left vacant for serving girls and attendants. Someone clears his throat loudly next to me. I look to my left and all but groan. Mr. Redfern.
Indeed, Miss McKean.
You here to keep an eye on us? It would be difficult to steal the silver when everyone's using it. His lip twitches.
You aren't the only one working tonight.
I nod. Well then, what exactly are we supposed to do?
Wait and watch our betters eat.
The man crosses his arms, and there's a recognizable bitterness to his voice that asks for no response. The first course is served, a cream-based soup the servants ladle out from a large tureen. I sniff the air. Crab bisque. It looks heavenly. Mr. Redfern watches me intently, and I shrug. What? I ask.
You aren't missing anything. He says, what they're eating is a little past its prime. Caught it in days ago from the docks. You girls eat better out at the school.
My stomach growls, and I shift. Would that we had eaten. Mr. Redfern shrugs.
Lesson learned, I suppose.
It's the first time he's been anything but dismissive to me, and I seize the opportunity to pry. What tribe are you from, Mr. Redfern?
Lenape. I doubt you've heard of us. My people don't exactly get featured in the weekly serials.
Is Redfern a Lenape name? His lips tighten.
No. It was the name given to me by a teacher at the school I was sent to when I was six.
I brighten and cling tight to the fact that we have something in common. Did you go to a combat school? He doesn't look at me as he answers.
They called it an industrial school, but yes.
What was it like?
They took me from my family, cut my hair, beat me every time they felt like it, and sent me to work for the mayor when I was 18.
His expression is still calm. Sounds familiar, I say, before I consider my words too carefully. His eyes widen slightly, and he looks straight ahead once more.
You should spend less time conversing, and more time listening.
You don't like me very much, and I ain't sure why. I've done nothing to earn it. His words have opened up an ugly feeling in me, part rage at the unfairness of it all. Part anguish, and I don't know what to do with it but throw it back at Mr. Redfern.
I've seen you skulking on the county roads in the dead of night, Miss McKean. Do you know they call you the angel of the crossroads, the people you save?
I get an uncomfortable feeling like I'm sliding backward down a slope into a deep hole that I dug my own self. If people are whispering about me, that isn't good. Stories have power, and how long will it be before Miss Preston hears about my nocturnal exploits? Mr. Redfern continues.
I don't like you because you're arrogant and self-important. You could be so much better than you are, but you're too selfish to see it.
There ain't much I can say to that.
His words sting, and he isn't even looking at me to determine their impact. Next to me, Catherine hasn't said a word during our entire exchange. Just kept watch over the white folks eating their meals. Seems like as good a plan as any. So I look straight ahead and wish the time away. The servants return to clear the plates and set down the next course. A fruit compote with cheese melted on top. Then there's a fish course that smells like something died, yet all those fine gentlemen and ladies gobble it up. All the while there's a fierce hollowness gnawing at my insides, and I try to imagine a life of this, watching fine people eat while I nigh on starve to death. It's the first time I've considered what the life of an attendant might truly be like. It ain't a comforting thought. Up to now, I've been focused on whatever mischief Jackson is getting mixed up with, Mr. Redfern's inscrutable glare, and the food everyone has been eating. I've been so preoccupied that I've just now noticed Miss Anderson's companion, a sickly pale man who is draining his third glass of wine. The man sweats, dabbing his brow with his pocket square, his hands shaking as he puts it away. Next to him, Miss Anderson is talking, but the man is too far gone to pay her proper attention. Saliva makes a discreet trail down the side of his mouth, and he reaches with clumsy hands for his napkin. He's turning, right there at the table. Any moment now, his eyes will start to yellow, and when he does, Miss Anderson will be his first course. I don't have a moment to wonder how on earth this rich man could have become infected. I look around to see if anyone else notices what I do, but Catherine stares into the distance, the disciplined gaze that functions to make our charges feel watched and not watched at the same time, and Mr. Redfern is speaking in low voices with one of the servants, directing the girl to stop serving wine to this guest or that one. Even Miss Anderson is too busy with her own wine glass to see that her neighbor is panting, laboring under the change his body is going through. I tap my companion's shoulder. Mr. Redfern? He gives me an irritated glare before turning back to the conversation with the serving girl on his other side. I grab his arm, shaking him. Mr. Redfern! His head whips around. What? He snarls, all pretense of manners gone. Might I borrow your blade for a moment? I ask, sweetly, pointing across the table to the man stumbling to his feet, knocking over glasses as he does so. A low growl comes from his throat, and a chorus of answering screams ring through the dining room as everyone realizes that there's a shambler in their midst. Mr. Redfern seems to be as much in shock as everyone else, so I grab his blade without waiting for permission. I heft the knife in my hand, taking just long enough to get a feel for the weight. Then, as the man lunges for Miss Anderson, I hurl the knife through the air. It's a good throw, and the blade goes end over end between the heads of the dinner guests before lodging squarely in the temple of the shambler. For a moment, the creature continues its grab for Miss Anderson before crashing to the floor in a tangle of limbs. My instructor backs away in terror, her face gone pale as she stares at me across the table. Everyone's eyes are upon me now, their faces twisted in disgust, as if killing a dinner guest, shambler or no, is a terrible faux pas. My word, the mayor's wife says from the far end of the table. The look she gives me makes me feel less human and more like a bear that's managed to stumble into the middle of dinner. Yes, it was an amazing throw, wasn't it? Catherine says, her voice a tad too bright. Jane was first in our class for knife handling. You should see what she can do at 30 feet. No one answers, but the Mrs. Duncan and Anderson both give me looks that make it clear that I have very much made a mistake. Feh, I should have let the shambler eat Miss Anderson's face.
I dare say my education here has been more than a little enlightening. You cannot fathom the benefits I have reaped here in Maryland. Sometimes riches are bestowed upon me whether I want them or not. Chapter 14. In which I go snooping.
Yet again, we owe our gratitude to the fine young ladies of Miss Preston's,
says Mayor Carr, once everyone at the table has calmed down.
While I do wish they were perhaps a bit more discreet in their work, I can't deny that this is twice this month that they've saved us from a rather rare and unfortunate accident.
He pulls the napkin from where it's tucked into his collar, folds it, and places it next to his plate.
Well, I think we can officially consider the dinner portion of our evening concluded, no?
At this he smiles, and his guests give a tentative laugh.
Let's allow my house staff to tidy up in here. Gentlemen, I invite you to join me for cigars and brandy. Pre-war, of course.
Despite this fine invitation, not everyone remains. A fair few people quietly make their excuses and leave. Maybe it's due to my thrilling knife-throwing skills, but I get the feeling it has more to do with seeing one of their friends turn shambler before their very eyes. He couldn't have been that popular, though. Most of the mayor's cronies and their wives remain, and Catherine and I are informed by Miss Anderson that we are to join the women in the salon while they partake of sherry, fruit, and cheese.
Are you serious? I whisper, for the sake of decorum.
A man just turned shambler in the middle of Baltimore County,
and nobody cares how it happened?
What are you suggesting, Miss McKean? Miss Anderson smiles tightly to a passing party guest before turning her attention back to me.
That there's a pack of shamblers here in the city?
The man was probably bitten on the road coming here and failed to disclose it. A terrible breach of decorum, but nothing more. A rogue shambler slipping through the county line patrols and bothering a pony near the city walls is not unheard of.
But it's not just one shambler, Miss Anderson, I shoot back. The Edgars were attacked inside the county line, and the...
I catch myself before letting the Spencer's name slip.
I've heard rumors other families have gone missing as well.
Miss Anderson straightens and adjusts her gloves. When she speaks, her words are straight razors.
I don't know where you have heard this gossip, but I can assure you we're quite well protected here. Now, unless you two want to find yourselves expelled from Miss Preston's this very evening, I suggest you freshen yourselves up and get into that parlor.
Rather than continue to argue, I nod and curtsy. As Miss Anderson walks away, I ask a servant where the comfort room is and hurry off down the hall. I've heard enough from Baltimore's upper crust, and I aim to find my own answers. But Catherine is hot on my heels.
Where are you going? She whispers.
Anywhere but in there, I say.
Jane, you threw a bowie knife at one of the mayor's guests. That man, by the way, was an editor for The Sun. His death is going to be all over the front page tomorrow, and the mayor's wife is distraught.
Catherine, can you hear how ridiculous that sounds? We could have died. Who cares what the newspaper thinks? Half the city can't read it anyway.
Catherine stops. I'm not saying you're wrong, Jane McKean.
What?
I agree with you. Something is very, very rotten here. But you're not going to get what you want from them, especially after throwing a knife into a man's face at the dinner table. All they care about is how it will look in the papers. Now think for a moment. The man could have gotten bit out on the roads, but that's unlikely, don't you think?
I shift from foot to foot. The fact Catherine is on my side is as much a surprise as her cool logic.
The bite takes anywhere from a few minutes to an hour or so to change a person. We were on the last course. How long ago had the man been bitten? Could he have somehow gotten the bite here, at the mayor's estate? I don't know, Kate, but I do know that I need to find the comfort room in a hurry, or I am going to embarrass myself yet again. Catherine makes a face.
Look, we need to get to the bottom of all this. If neither of us are in that parlor, they're going to come looking. I'll cover for you as long as I can.
I nod and hurry down the hall, my brain turning over the possibilities of a shambler being in Mayor Carr's house. The mayor doesn't strike me as a foolish man, so I can't imagine he would tolerate the kind of incompetence that would allow the undead on his property. So does that mean he has them here purposefully? Why would a man like him keep the dead around? It's such a ridiculous line of thought that I shake my head. There has to be a reasonable explanation, one that doesn't involve Baltimore's mayor keeping shamblers as pets. I just got to figure out what it is. Despite a head full of questions and suppositions, I still manage to find a latrine. But before I can make use of the mayor's very fancy water closet, I see Jackson, waving at me from a doorway at the end of the hall. A quick glance reveals that no one is around to see me, and I sprint down the hallway and duck into the room.
What are you doing?
I whisper, my eyes adjusting to the low light. There are gas lamps on the walls, but they ain't lit, and even though a bit of light filters in through the windows, it is too dark to see anything other than the vague outline of bookshelves and a massive square that I take to be a desk.
I need your help, Jackson says, striking a match and lighting a kerosene lantern. I'm supposed to be in the cellar bringing up a couple of bottles of port for the men, but I saw you duck out and figured you were looking for evidence of where Lily is.
Please, I was trying to use the water closet. Now, if you'll excuse me.
Even if I am looking for answers, Red Jack is only going to get me caught. I make to leave, but he grabs my arm.
Jackson? Jane,
you know I wouldn't ask if I didn't have to.
I cross my arms and he sighs.
I know things ended badly between us, and you've always been more accommodating than I got any right to expect. But you know I can't read a damn word of the files the mayor's got in here. I don't know what's the household accounting and what might be dastardly. So I'm asking you, with a whole heap of consideration I don't deserve, will you please help me?
The lamplight plays across Jackson's features. But somehow, I don't think he's acting. If he's desperate enough to mention our falling out, then I know he's worried something fierce. Even so, nowhere in that speech did I hear an apology. I just want you to know that I'm doing this for Lily, not you. As far as I'm concerned, you can rot in hell. Relief relaxes his features and he nods. I purse my lips, taking in the desk and accompanying drawers. Here, hold the light so I can see. The mayor's desk is well organized, and there are enough cost sheets and file folders that my head spins. I open the drawers beside the desk, but there's nothing unusual. Just the normal ledger keeping and invoices you'd expect for a tobacco farm. I try to pull out the bottom drawer, and it refuses to budge. I wave Jackson over and point to the drawer.
Can you get it open?
He sets the lantern on the desk.
You got a hairpin?
I touch my hair and pull one out, thankful when the weight and mass of my hair stays put. Jackson starts to work on the lock, glancing up at me, his expression nearly unreadable in the dark.
You look real pretty tonight.
I don't say anything, my heart thumping in my chest. Never once did Jackson ever tell me I was pretty before things went bad. I think he always took me for granted. Even when I was throwing bottles at his head and telling him what a louse he was, he still seemed surprised, as though he never thought I'd get mad enough to tell him things between us were over.
That get-up really does something for you, Jenny Jane. I can see why you take your training and all that so serious. You belong to this life. You'll be a brilliant attendant.
The drawer pops open, saving me from having to answer him. Jackson reaches in and pulls out a thick ledger book. Look, I say, tapping the front. Summerland is written there in gold embossed letters. What's Summerland?
I have no idea.
I open the book, but before I get very far, there's the unmistakable sound of a gun cocking. Summerland is a town in Kansas. Nice place, bit of a work in progress, like most frontier towns. And I get the feeling you're going to get to see it firsthand. The room brightens. Miss Anderson lighting a gas lamp on the wall, a macabre grin on her face. The light reveals Mr. Redfern in the doorway, a nice pair of six-shooters leveled at me and Jackson.
Miss McKean, Red Jack,
he says, drawing room polite.
I do believe the mayor is expecting you.
I must apologize. This letter has gotten much longer than I expected it to be. Please give the aunties my love, and tell Auntie Eliza that I'm expecting a pecan pie when I return. I love you, Mama, more than anything on earth or in the Lord's heavens above. Please stay safe. I shall be home soon. Chapter 15. In which my fate is decided. Miss Anderson strips me of my weapons before she claps me and Red Jack in irons and leads us down a back staircase to a lower part of the house. Jackson's face is impassive, and I try to mimic his calm demeanor. I'm afraid I fail miserably. My stomach is all angry butterflies and nerves, and I feel like I'm going to lose what little control I have at any moment. I also still need to empty my bladder, which is not helping the situation at all. I've been in trouble before, but somehow the gun pointed at my back and the heavy irons on my wrists make me think that this is much worse than stealing a pie from the kitchens. The staircase is steep. And just when I wonder if it will ever end, we enter a long corridor lit by gas lamps. The flames flicker, making the deep shadows on the stone walls dance drunkenly. From down the hallway comes a long, low howl. The hair along my arm stands on end, and Miss Anderson gives me a wide grin. "You hear them, don't you?" she says. The mayor keeps shamblers? Of course not. Don't be ridiculous. That's his dogs. The kennels are at the end of this corridor. You're even stupider than I thought, she says with a sneer. I'm beginning to think she truly doesn't care for me. Miss Anderson stops and knocks on a fancy door carved to depict Adam and Eve fleeing the garden. The angel casting them out looks a mite bit like the mayor. That does not help my nervousness one bit. Someone calls.
Enter!
Miss Anderson opens the door and leads the way in, grinning like a kid on Christmas. We got them, sir! She crows, all but doing a little jig as she presents us like trophy bucks. They went right for the office like I said they would. Behind a large desk sits Mayor Carr, puffing away on a cigar, a glass of port in his hand. He leans back in his chair, a massive beast of a man. This close, it's easy to see why people stand in awe of him. He radiates power, his dark eyes shrewd and intelligent. The man possesses quite an imposing air, one of barely repressed violence. Not many people stand in the mayor's way and live to tell about it. He puffs on his cigar, leisurely blowing smoke rings.
I do believe it was Mr. Redfern who said that, given the opportunity to snoop, Miss McKean and her companion would find themselves hard put to contain themselves. So the kudos must go to Mr. Redfern, not you, Miss Anderson.
Miss Anderson's face goes stormy, and I smile to myself despite the danger we're in. Looks like the mayor ain't so keen on her, either. Anyway, we caught them, sir. Want us to cut them? They'd make fine shambler bait, and we've quite the issue with a roaming pack out toward the waterfront. Or we could add them to Professor Gruton's experiment. Election season is coming up, and no one ever misses a few darkies. Rage swells in my heart, and my composure breaks. You vile woman, I yell, unable to contain myself. I should have let that shambler eat your miserable hide at dinner.
Silence!
The mayor leans forward, placing his cigar in a crystal ashtray, and setting his glass of port down as well before hauling himself from the chair. He walks over to me and Red Jack, a look of careful consideration on his face.
This is your problem, Miss Anderson. You are all passion. No sense. I suppose it's not your fault, being a woman and all.
The mayor grasps my chin, turning my face this way and that like he's inspecting a horse for sale. I jerk away from his clammy touch, and he gives me a grin.
Either way, you need to think about the larger end goal. Both of these Negroes are smart. Smarter than they have any right to be. We can't have them here in Baltimore. They're already stirring up too much trouble. And using them for shambler bait is such a waste. We have the criminals in the jails for that. But I think they'd be useful in Summerland. The preacher might be able to curb their baser instincts, and the sheriff has a way about him that is conducive to corralling wayward Negroes. What do you think, Abigail?
There's movement from a chair to the left, and my mouth opens with shock when Miss Preston walks over to stand next to the mayor. Gone is the kind expression I've come to know. Instead, she gives me a hard glare, and I unwittingly shrink into myself.
I have no information about this fella here, but Jane is one of my best girls. Where is her companion?
Catherine is still upstairs with Miss Duncan. She doesn't have a thing to do with this, Miss Anderson says, answering too quickly. Catherine has long been her favorite, and whatever this Summerland is, she most likely doesn't want Catherine sent off there.
I do agree that Catherine likely isn't a part of this,
Miss Preston turns back to the mayor.
But she is too pretty for any respectable woman to hire on as a companion. I've had several possible contracts fall through once the family saw her. She might find better use as an incentive for the men out west. After all, she came to us by way of a house of ill repute. I'm sure she knows a few tricks to keep the men in line.
I'd like to assign her as a Summerland attendant. Keep the women folk happy,
the mayor says.
The girls we got from down south didn't pan out, and if Summerland is going to be successful, we need investors. That means a better quality of people. In the event that fails, then we can set her up as one of the Duchess's girls.
He turns to Miss Anderson.
Fetch her down here. Tell her I would like to give her my thanks personally for her valor at the lecture.
Miss Anderson's lips purse, but she does as she's told. I think about how attendants never seem to survive much past a couple of years. How girls never come back to visit once they've graduated. Not even the girls that don't get contracts with fine families. How long have you been feeding him girls for whatever this fool scheme is? I ask, directing my question to Miss Preston. She gives me a lovely smile and pats my cheek affectionately.
As long as there's been a Miss Preston School of Combat for Negro girls, there's been a Summerland. The West is savage, what with the Indians and the Shamblers and the wildlife. If one doesn't get you, another surely will. But my girls have helped to make Summerland a town of the future.
Mayor Carr's expression goes dreamy.
Imagine it. A utopia on the western plains, safe enough to withstand any Shambler attack.
He smiles.
America, as it should be, once more. What price can one put on that?
You're deranged, Jackson says. It's the first he's spoken since Miss Anderson clapped us in irons, and the expression on his face is murderous, like he'd love nothing more than to gut the mayor and Miss Preston. I reckon my face looks about the same. The mayor laughs.
Such fire! I do admire the Negro's ability to continue fighting, even in the face of overwhelming odds.
A muscle in Jackson's jaw flexes, but he says nothing. The mayor continues.
Summerland is a city on a hill. A place where people can raise their families without worrying about any of this nasty Shambler business.
You mean what Baltimore County is supposed to be? I shoot back at him. I've seen packs of Shamblers in the woods. I've killed them. All of that talk about making the county safe, about it being Shambler free, it was all a lie. The mayor shakes his head at this.
It wasn't a lie. Our walls, our patrols, the Native and Negro Reeducation Act, it was all working for a while. But in the last year, we've come to realize that no matter how hard we push, those damn Shamblers push back even harder. These eastern cities are lost, girl. Finished. We can't rebuild America on a foundation rotted by war and plague. We need to start over again. Summerland is that start. You sent the Spencers there, didn't you?
Jackson asks. Mayor Carr laughs.
The Spencers went willingly once they heard my offer. Safety is a precious commodity in these turbulent times.
Jackson's shoulders fall.
But the Spencers are egalitarians. They were rallying against your senatorial campaign.
The mayor gives an eloquent shrug.
It's amazing what a few months fighting the undead and struggling to survive can do to change a man's perspective. Some of my best allies were once egalitarians. People care less about doing the right thing than they do about being safe, especially when they have little ones to look after. Ah. And here is our third musketeer.
The door opens, and Catherine enters, her smile fading quickly when her eyes land on me and Red Jack. Wait, what is this? She asks in surprise.
I am afraid, Miss Devereaux, that this is both hello and goodbye,
says the mayor. He nods and Miss Anderson takes Catherine's weapons and puts a pair of irons on her as well, although judging by Miss Anderson's face, it pains her to do so. The mayor holds his hands out and smiles apologetically.
Such long faces. Cheer up, friends. Many a scoundrel has made their fortune out west. Of course, that is all assuming you survive.
There's a knock behind us. And a white man with red hair sticks his head into the room.
Sorry to interrupt, Mayor Carr, but we've got another breach. Looks like a good-sized pack. George got bit, so Jasper said we needed to let you know we put him down and ain't got no one to handle the dogs now.
The mayor's face flushes, and he points to the man.
Put Evan on the dogs, and make sure those damn Shamblers don't breach the secondary again. I have guests.
Catherine holds her head high, even though her eyes swim with tears. She's nothing but collateral damage in this whole mess, and it makes me feel some kind of way. Especially when she looks at me and gives me a rueful grin. Well, Jane, it looks like you were right after all. Strange, hearing her say it doesn't give me much satisfaction. The man hurries out, and the mayor returns to his chair, picking up his cigar once more.
As you can see, I have other, more important matters to attend to. The train leaves in the morning. You'll spend tonight in the cellars, which may be a bit damp, but are cool and quite comfortable. I urge you to get as much rest as you can. Life out west is harder than anything you're used to, at least for your kind.
The mayor puffs leisurely on his cigar.
And if you prove yourselves useful, as Mr. Redfern has, well, you might just have a future after all.
One more thing, Mr. Mayor, if you don't mind, I say.
Yes, Miss McKean.
Might I use your comfort room before we are locked up? I would hate to embarrass myself during my exile. The mayor smiles and nods.
Of course, Miss McKean. I'm a politician, not a monster.
Miss Anderson leads the way out, Mr. Redfern gesturing with his revolver for us to follow. We do. Our steps slow and dejected. I have never felt so hopeless in all my life. Part 2. The Cruel West. Dearest Jane, oh my dear, how good it is to have your words and to read such lovely penmanship. There's no greater joy for a mother than to know her only child is doing well. I see that Miss Preston's has had quite a positive impact on your life, though I dare say the memory of the day you left still pains me greatly. Chapter 16, in which I have a revelation. The train leaves promptly at 6, and we are dragged through the early morning dark to meet it. Catherine and I wear our attendance uniforms, and Red Jack is still dressed in the white shirt and apron of a house servant. Mr. Redfern walks behind us, gun leveled at our backs, just in case we get any fancy ideas. I am sure we make quite a sight to any who witness our parade. On the train, we're guided not to a passenger car, but a cargo car. Miss Anderson stands waiting for us, sliding the door open and gesturing for us to climb inside. Jackson catches my eye and winks.
I always told you I'd take you away from all of this, he murmurs, low enough that only I hear him.
How he can have such a jovial attitude when the situation is most dire is something I cannot explain. Miss Anderson locks our chains to steel rings in the floor, tossing the keys to Mr. Redfern, who catches them one-handed. Miss Anderson smiles down at me. I have waited for this day ever since you first came to Miss Preston's. I hope Sheriff Snyder flays you bloody.
And I hope a horde of shamblers chews your face off, you miserable wretch, I say.
Miss Anderson draws her hand back and slaps me across the face, my head whipping around from the blow. The coppery taste of blood fills my mouth, and I spit, aiming at Miss Anderson's boots. Sadly, I am not even close. So much for my etiquette instruction. Miss Anderson turns to go, but then hesitates. One last thing, she says. She reaches into the pocket of her skirt and takes out a thick packet of letters, envelopes of fine lavender vellum. These are from your mother, Jane. The postmaster is a friend of mine and was happy to help me make sure you didn't continue to violate school rules.
And I believe at this point your mother probably takes you for dead, since she hasn't received one of your letters in ever so long, either. Miss Anderson tosses the packet of letters just out of reach, partway between me and Catherine. One look reveals the writing as my mama's, and something breaks in me.
I will kill you, you conniving bitch!
I scream, straining against my chains and lurching forward as far as they will allow. Miss Anderson just laughs as Mr. Redfern helps her down from the train car, the door slamming closed. I scream, a sound of pure animalistic rage, and before I know it, tears are running down my cheeks, my pain and frustration a living thing. All this time I despaired over my mama, whether she was alive, whether she'd be happy to see me when I returned, whether I'd imagined her tenderness and her love. All this time I waited for answers and got not a one. My slavish devotion answered with silence from her, or so I thought.
Jane, you have to calm down. It's going to get hot in here, and they didn't leave us with any water, Jane.
Catherine's voice is tremulous, and I realize that I ain't the only one being sent off into the unknown. Red, Jack, and Catherine are here with me, and I owe it to them to try to retain some of my sanity.
I'm going to kill her, I say, my voice low.
I use the fine material of my skirt to scrub my face of the snot and tears, the chains around my wrists digging into the soft skin. I take a deep, shuddering breath. I'm going to kill her and Miss Preston and the mayor, all of them. I'm going to gut them like fish and use them as shambler bait. Then I'm going to burn both the school and the mayor's house to the ground and dance upon the ashes.
That's good, Jane. That's good. It's good to have goals, Catherine says, her voice trembling.
She hiccups and begins to cry. I should offer her some soothing words, but I am a knot of rage and violence, and I ain't got anything like her platitudes. Outside, the train whistle blows, and I settle in for the long haul, planning my bloody revenge. On one side of me, Catherine cries quiet tears, and on the other, Jackson says nothing. The sound of his heavy breaths the only indication that he is even there. Life at Rose Hill is much the same as when you were here, although I must admit that we all sorely miss your sunny disposition. Chapter 17, in which I am welcomed to Summerland. The next few days are a lesson in slow torture. The train car is an oven, and the vibration of the wheels rattles our bones until I'm positive we will arrive out west little more than a bowl of jelly. Every so often the train jerks to a stop, throwing us violently to the side, the door opening up to reveal Mr. Redfern. He gives us water and hard bread before taking us out to relieve ourselves along the track. We have no weapons, so it's nerve-wracking to squat amongst the tall weeds and do our business. The movement and the fresh air are a brief respite before we are loaded back onto the train, and we begin our journey once more. I lose all track of time, although I do eventually pick up the packet of letters. It's too dark in the gloom to read them, but there's no mistaking my name scrawled across the front in my mother's handwriting. I hide them in my skirt pocket next to Tom Sawyer. I ain't sure when the last letter arrived, but just looking at them is enough to ignite my rage all over again. One day, I will return to Baltimore, and when I do, there will be hell to pay. We don't talk much on the trip. I suppose we're all stuck in our own dark thoughts. At night, when the train car cools enough for us to sleep a little, I hear Catherine crying softly,
trying to hide the sound of her tears by burying her face in her knees. I feel bad for her. She really did get the worst kind of deal. Here she is, following the rules for years, working toward nothing more than being some lady's attendant, and the powers that be decide she's too pretty for such drudgery and ship her out west. It's the worst kind of betrayal. The third night that I wake to her crying, my guilt gets the better of me. I'm sorry you got caught up in this. I'm sorry you won't be an attendant, I say. Catherine laughs in the dark, the sound flat. Oh, Jane, I never much cared about being an attendant. All I ever wanted was to be free. Her words give me too much to think about. Why do you think the survivalists lied about Baltimore being safe? She continues.
Power, Jackson says, bitterness lacing his voice. It's the only thing that men like them want.
People wanted to believe them, I mutter, thinking about poor Othello from the lecture and his willingness to die for Professor Gehring's delusions. They wanted everything to go back to the way it was before the war, before the killing, the shamblers, the walls, all of it. That's how men like the mayor maintained control. You believe strongly enough in an idea, nothing else much matters. If everything the survivalists have been saying is a lie, then no one is safe, Catherine says. We never were, I say. The memory of Miss Preston's betrayal stings anew. There ain't much to say after that. After what seems like months, but in reality is only about 5 days, the train stops once again. This time when the door opens wide and my eyes finally adjust to the too bright light, there are 3 rough-looking fellows holding shotguns.
Welcome to the great state of Kansas. Wonder how long you'll survive, one says, his voice high and squeaky.
He gives us a gap-toothed grin. It's all I can do not to roll my eyes. After nearly a week of being cooked alive and shaken out of my skin, I'm irritable and in no mood to deal with a bunch of toothless bullies. I hold my chained hands up. When are you gonna unlock these? Or are you just going to stand there wasting daylight? Squeaky takes a step back, his grin fading to a look of surprise. I reckon most folks show up scared as a mouse in a trap after such a brutal trip. But Miss Anderson's revelation and the long, slow ride to mull it over has just given me a mean feeling. Right now, I don't care about much else but the 2 tasks before me. First, find my mama. My mother is alive and probably thinks I am dead. I have to find her and tell her the truth. That means I have to find a way back to Rose Hill, and quick-like. But I have to bring Catherine and Jackson along as well. I can't leave them stranded on the prairie. Plus, I'm going to need their help to survive the trip. Before I can do any of that, though, I have to survive. By any means necessary. And from the stories I've read of the Western frontier, that ain't gonna be easy. The 3 dimwits staring at us don't move, so I shake my chains at them.
Yo! You wanna get us out or not?
Gentlemen.
Mr. Redfern's low voice causes the louts to step aside uncertainly, and he leaps into the rail car with an easy grace. He unlocks our chains, and for a moment, I think about hitting him upside the head and making a run for it. But just like before, like the many stops along the way, I don't. I have no idea where I am and how to get back to civilization. No weapons, no food, no nothing. I will plan my escape, but now is not the time or place. Unfortunately, Jackson is not possessed of such calm and reasoned logic. Once his hands are free, he hauls back and punches Mr. Redfern in the face. The man ain't expecting it, and he goes down like a sack of rocks.
Let's go!
Jackson yells before launching himself from the train car and running off. Catherine is still chained to the floor, and our eyes meet in surprise and disbelief. Mr. Redfern climbs to his feet, fists clenched and jaw locked. I hold my hands up. That boy is all impulse.